Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, April 21st, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing and defining the waters of the U.S. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of our two experts of about 10 to 15 minutes, then a little back and forth, but as always, turning to you, the audience, for your questions. First up today will be Mr. Brent A. Fuel. He's a partner at Troutman Sanders. And then he'll be followed by Professor Patrick A. Parento. He is a professor of law and senior counsel to the Environmental Law Clinic at the Vermont Law School. With that, Mr. Fuel, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you, Dean, and thank you to the Federalist Society for this opportunity to talk to you briefly about the major rulemaking waters of the U.S. Just a little bit about my background. I got my start as a young environmental scientist in the 90s, doing wetland delineations and Clean Water Act permitting, and subsequently served in EPA's Office of Waters, the number two in the Bush administration from 2004 to 2007. And the topic we're talking about today obviously was very important to the agency. When I was there, the Rapanos decision, a very seminal case, came down. We'll be talking about that case shortly. But so my perspective is both as a former scientist, a regulator, and also as a lawyer who advises regulated entities on a daily basis. But what I think might be helpful for folks on the phone is for me to provide a quick context for the rulemaking. Why now? What does the rule do? And why the fuss? And then I'll offer some personal observations on the merits of the proposed rule itself. First, I think the professor and I would agree that with EPA that the primary purpose of the rule, again, it's a proposed rule that was proposed in April of last year, is to provide greater clarity and certainty for demarcating the boundary between federal and non-federal lands and waters. The rule is largely in response to what you might say is confusion caused by the Supreme Court's 2006 decision in Rapanos, which came down when I was also at the agency. The proposed rule is also intended to replace the EPA guidance that was developed in 2008, subsequent to Rapanos, which I helped to author when I was at the agency. As I mentioned, the rule was proposed in April of last year. It's currently over at OMB, and it may be finalized and published as early as the end of this month, most likely sometime next month. But you know, given the significance of this rule and the controversy surrounding it, there was over a million comments submitted to the EPA and the Corps on the rule, and the agency had to spend a fair amount of time sorting through those comments. I should also offer a quick primer on the Federal Clean Water Act's authority, which for some of you that may not be as familiar with the Clean Water Act may be helpful. Now, for starters, the Act provides federal jurisdiction over, quote-unquote, navigable waters, which is historically has been a term based in the notions of traditional commerce. Navigable waters is also defined under the Act as waters of the United States. So EPA and the Corps of Engineers have concurrent jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act, although the Corps has primary permitting authority under Section 404 for dredge and fill permitting activities that impact water, such as wetlands and streams and other water jurisdictional water bodies. The existing rule that EPA and the Corps are looking to revise is a rule that has not been revised since 1986. So we're dealing with a fairly old rule that is in need of being updated to conform to Supreme Court decisional law. But it's also important to note that the definition, this rule that redefines waters of the U.S., is not just limited to Section 404 dredge and fill activities, but all programs and sections under the Clean Water Act. So the implications of the regulation, you know, are far more reaching and greater than simply whether one needs a permit to fill in a wetland somewhere. Maybe I'll also spend a couple of minutes summarizing the seminal Supreme Court decisions at issue. There's three of them. The first was a 2001 Swank decision that involved a question regarding the Corps of Engineers' authority to regulate isolated intrastate non-navigable waters under the Corps' migratory bird rule. And I should note that the migratory bird rule wasn't a rule, wasn't even a rule, rather it was the Corps' interpretation of its authority under the 1986 regulations in the statute. But the implications of the migratory bird rule was that the government could assert authority over essentially any water that was used or could potentially be used by migratory birds. We're not just talking ducks, but all migratory birds that cross interstate boundaries and also federally listed species. So the migratory bird rule represented extremely broad authority. But as a practical matter, you know, the Corps did not exercise its authority to the fullest extent, even under its own interpretation back then. There were certain water bodies that obviously had greater ecological significance to migratory birds, and those were the water bodies that the Corps would often exercise its authority, particularly isolated water bodies. The Swank decision ruling was a 5-4 decision, and then Chief Justice Rehnquist, who authored the majority opinion, rejected the Corps' interpretation as not supported by the Act. So fast forward to 2006 when the Rapanos decision was rendered. The Rapanos decision involved the question of jurisdiction over wetlands adjacent to tributaries remote to traditional navigable waters. These were not wetlands adjacent to navigable waters, but wetlands adjacent to tributaries, non-navigable tributaries to navigable waters. So the wetlands in issue in Rapanos were, if I recall correctly, approximately 20 miles from the nearest navigable water, and it was connected by a series of man-made ditches, drains, and culverts. And the Rapanos case was a highly fractured decision. It was a 4-1-4 decision with five separate opinions. Justice Scalia offered the plurality opinion and concluded that waters of the U.S. extended only so far as wetlands adjacent to waters that are relatively permanent, standing, or flowing. So again, Scalia and the plurality felt that wetlands that were jurisdictional and adjacent to other water bodies, those water bodies must be relatively permanent, standing, or flowing. And Scalia also defined adjacency as having a continuous surface connection, and that's important because we'll talk later about other connections that the rule considers. Justice Kennedy's concurrence took a little different approach. He was the one in the 414 decision. Kennedy held that a wetland or a non-navigable water fell within the Act's ambit if it bears a significant nexus to a traditional navigable waterway. This has become known as the significant nexus test. And according to Kennedy, such nexus would exist where a wetland or a water body, either by itself or in combination with other similarly situated sites, significantly affect the physical, biological, and chemical integrity of the downstream navigable waterway. This last, the part of the Kennedy test dealing with combination with other similar sites has been known as the aggregation standard, where the federal government can look to and aggregate otherwise non-significant waters with non-significant connections, but in their totality may have a significant effect on the quality of downstream waters. So think Wickard v. Filburn. I also wanted to mention the third seminal case was a 1985 Supreme Court decision involving U.S. versus Riverside Bayview, which considered the Corps' jurisdiction over wetlands adjacent to and directly abutting traditional navigable waters. This case is important because the Court introduced for the first time the concept of significant nexus. But understand that significant nexus was used in the limited context of wetlands directly adjacent to navigable waters. But in the Rapanos decision, Justice Kennedy took that significant nexus standard and applied it much more broadly. The Court held in Riverside Bayview that jurisdiction could extend to adjacent wetlands, that abutted and were inextricably intertwined to and inseparable from navigable waters. So these were wetlands that were adjacent to. There was a lot of hydrologic communication with the navigable water, a lot of flooding, water moving back and forth. So the Corps basically said these waters are inseparable, and so it's a fair interpretation of the Corps' authority under the Act to regulate these adjacent wetlands. So while Riverside Bayview expanded the federal government's jurisdiction, both Rapanos and the Swank decisions significantly narrowed the government's authority under the Act. And it's fair to say that Chief Justice Roberts was none too happy about the outcome of Rapanos and, you know, and what could be described as an excoriating decision. Really took the Corps to task for not adopting a regulation in order to provide greater clarity and certainty and deference. And I'm just going to read here real quickly from Robert's opinion. He says, "The proposed rulemaking after Swank went nowhere. Rather than refining its view of its authority in light of our decision in Swank and providing guidance meriting deference under our generous standards, the Corps chose to adhere to its essentially balanced view the scope of its power. The upshot of today is another defeat for the agency, and regulated entities will now have to feel their way on a case-by-case basis." And so that's essentially what has happened after Rapanos. The government and regulated entities really have had a difficult time understanding what's jurisdictional. This has caused enormous challenges for EPA's enforcement program and deciding when to bring enforcement against unauthorized discharges into wetlands. It's also created enormous challenges and burdens to the regulated entities who, again, don't know where that boundary is. And in many cases, regulated entities, rather than go through a lengthy significant nexus analysis, have simply conceded jurisdiction in order to facilitate permitting. So let's fast forward to the present. What does the proposed rule do today? Well, in short, it would codify Justice Kennedy's significant nexus standard. The proposal establishes a number of categories of per se jurisdictional waters, but the most controversial ones are really three. What constitutes a jurisdictional tributary? Under the rule, this would extend to intermittent and ephemeral streams, and in many cases, drainage ditches, and I'll talk about that in a second. The second category that would be per se jurisdictional under this proposal would be adjacent wetlands, and we'll talk again more detail about how the agencies have defined adjacency. And then the third category, which I'll call kind of a catch-all, is all other waters, such as geographically isolated wetlands. But obviously the most significant controversy extends to jurisdiction over ephemeral and intermittent streams, ditches, and arroyos, dry arroyos in the west, and isolated wetlands in the headwaters of various watersheds. Under the proposal, all tributaries, this is very important to remember, all tributaries in adjacent wetlands would be deemed per se jurisdictional. The other categories, other waters, would be determined on a case-by-case basis. So just a couple of comments about tributaries and adjacent waters. The term tributary was broadly defined to include, as I mentioned, ephemeral and intermittent streams and many drainage ditches. But to be fair to EPA and the Corps, EPA has for the first time sought to exempt categories of ditches from jurisdiction under this rule, including those that are excavated and draining only uplands and those that do not contribute flow either directly or through another jurisdictional water body. However, as a practical matter, I think that the concern is that the exemptions will simply be swallowed by the rule. There's obviously significant concerns that most drainage ditches are going to drain somewhere, and then in many cases they're simply going to be intersected by jurisdictional waters at some point and thus become jurisdictional. Adjacent waters, the proposed rule would replace the term adjacent wetlands with the new term adjacent waters. So the concept of adjacency is expanded from wetlands to other waters. And adjacent waters would be defined as bordering, contiguous, and neighboring to traditional navigable waters. Under the new definition of neighboring, any water body that lies within a floodplain or riparian area, themselves newly defined terms under the proposal, or waters with a shallow subsurface hydrologic connection to a navigable water would be deemed jurisdictional. So if you can conceptualize a stream, a navigable water, adjacent wetlands to that navigable water, and then everything outside of adjacency, we're talking about these adjacent waters and also other waters that are beyond, farther away from jurisdictional waters than just adjacent waters. Now, just when Rapanos and Swank decision were rendered, obviously the agencies lost authority over a number of types of waters, including prairie potholes, Carolina Bays, in some cases Pocosins, vernal pools. These were isolated geographically isolated waters that in many cases simply jurisdiction would no longer be found. So it's fair to say that this rule seeks to try to find ways in order to find jurisdiction over those types of isolated water bodies. I mentioned earlier the aggregation approach. The agency has taken the position that it would have authority to broadly categorize as per se jurisdictional geographically isolated waters in certain ecoregions. So based on ecoregions, so large ecoregions like the southeast coastal plains could be defined as an ecoregion, and wetlands or other water bodies within those ecoregions may, under a final rule, be deemed jurisdictional. So let me just offer some personal observations. First of all, those that have been following this rule recognize the visceral response there's been to the proposal by many. I found it really telling when Congressman Hal Rogers, a Republican from Kentucky, basically called it, quote unquote, the biggest land grab in the history of the world. Now, I think the congressman was probably engaged in a bit of hyperbole, but I think you get a sense of the angst and frustration, that this proposal had created. And obviously the concern over regulating ditches prompted an outcry by many, including agriculture, who started a campaign called Ditch the Rule. EPA responded in kind with its own campaign called Ditch the Myth. So you had these two camps shooting back and forth on who was right and what the proposal did. And so there was just, there was a fair amount of acrimony and confusion regarding what EPA was intending to do and what the rule in fact did. And I would say, there's been an alarming disconnect between the proposal's text, some of these new definitions and ambiguous terms, and what EPA said about the rule and what I think it intended the rule to do. So, for example, the agency consistently defended the rule as limiting federal jurisdiction beyond its current and historic authorities. It also stated that the proposal represented only a 3% increase in the jurisdiction compared to 2009 and 2010 field practices. But I think that the statement, not only undermined, in my opinion, not only undermines EPA's position that the rule limits its authority, but the 3% figure, in my view, is a gross underestimation of the potential, and I emphasize potential, expansion of the government's authority under the proposed rule. And while it might be true the government's historic authority was extremely broad and boundless under the 1986 rule, the migratory bird rule, but the proposal's text seems to ignore the fact that the Supreme Court significantly narrowed the government's jurisdiction in both the Swank and Rapanos decision. Now, in fairness to EPA and the Corps, this is really tough stuff, and it's a complicated rulemaking. Always, anytime these types of rulemakings with jurisdictional issues come into play, it's going to evoke a significant response. Even when I was there, we put together the guidance. The guidance evoked, again, significant response from various stakeholders. But the rulemaking is made very complicated and more difficult by the complexity of the legal underpinnings and also the science. And you know, so despite my own concerns about the rule and how it was drafted, you know, I think EPA and the Corps have been fairly judicious in establishing the administrative record. You know, concurrent to the rulemaking, EPA published a 300-page scientific report citing to over 1,000 studies documenting the importance of the interconnections of waters, surface waters, and groundwater, and the importance on ecological systems. You know, but I would just also say, regardless of how the rule is written and, you know, regardless of where the lines are drawn in the landscape, no one is going to be happy with the rule. You know, I think as my friend Tracy Meehan noted recently, you know, he viewed it as a serious tension between the 19th century concept of navigability, as that term relates to commerce, and our 21st century understanding of ecological interconnections of water bodies. But the agency has said that it's listened to criticism and that it's going to address those concerns in the final rule. A couple of other comments before I just turn it over to Pat. I think the vast majority stakeholders believe a rule is needed. Jurisdictional determinations, in my view, should not be governed by policy alone. They should be governed by clear and authoritative rules. And I have been critical of the rule mainly because it failed to do what it set out to do. And it not only failed to provide clarity and certainty regarding the government's jurisdiction, but it actually creates even greater confusion and would, in my view, result in expansion or a potential expansion of federal jurisdiction. So, and I'm already hearing of cases where the Corps in the field, since this proposal was put out, is asserting jurisdiction over ditches that prior to this proposal would not have seen jurisdiction asserted over them. I also think that EPA and the Corps have taken some great liberties with Justice Kennedy's decision. In my view, again, the rule would expand jurisdiction as a practical matter. There's no doubt the agency's historic authority was extremely broad, but the Supreme Court significantly narrowed that jurisdiction. I also think the agencies have taken liberty with Kennedy's significant nexus test, and Kennedy may not even recognize the rule based on his own interpretation. The agency has stated, for example, I'll give you an example there. What I believe is a misreading of Kennedy's opinion, EPA has stated for the first time that a hydrologic connection is not necessary to establish jurisdiction. Rather, a biological connection itself under the proposed rule would be sufficient to assert jurisdiction. The agency has stated that the connections such as salamanders and frogs and aquatic birds moving back and forth to water bodies between navigable waters and non-navigable isolated waters would themselves be sufficient to establish jurisdiction. And then lastly, the broad and ambiguous terms under the proposal, things like adjacency and riparian areas and floodplains, the fact that these are not well-defined and standards not well-articulated creates obviously a lot of concern that jurisdiction will be found far more reaching than historically it has been. So, as you can see, there are a number of problems with the proposal, and we'll just have to wait and see if the EPA and Corps address those in the final proposal. So, Pat, I open up the floor to you.
Okay, Brent, fantastic job. You ought to come up here and teach this course instead of me. No, you did a really fine job of laying out the history and how we got to where we are, and I think it's fair to say that reasonable minds can disagree over the rule and over where to draw the line between federal and state jurisdiction. And in keeping with that theme, I will respectfully disagree with a couple of your points, but mostly I agree with the way you've framed the question. So I've got about maybe a dozen quickie bullet points to make. Number one, blame SCOTUS. Blame the Supreme Court for this mess, not EPA. Don't shoot the messenger on this one, is my first point. You know, Chief Justice Roberts, this was his first sort of significant controversial case where there was that clear ideological split on the court. It had been there before, as Brent had already described in the Swank case. And I think, frankly, if this case had come to the court A few years later, say after Roberts got his sea legs and started to look at his role as leader of the court in trying to bridge differences of opinion and find common ground, I think we actually might have seen a different opinion than the fractured mess that the court left us with in Rapano. So blame the Supreme Court, number one. Number two, blame Congress for the problem. Congress had an opportunity to amend the Clean Water Act. The Obama administration tried to do that and made a little bit of headway early on in the House. And actually, there was a bill in the Senate as well. Didn't go anywhere, of course. So blame Congress. You know, when the Supreme Court says Congress has not clearly indicated its intent in how to define this term, waters of the United States, it's certainly incumbent, I would say, upon Congress to do so. And its failure to do so in 1972 has led to where we are today, and its failure to do so today has led to EPA taking the step of promulgating a rule. I might say that, of course, Chief Justice Roberts in Rapanos, as Brent already mentioned, specifically and pointedly called upon the Corps and EPA, this program is jointly administered, as Brent mentioned, the definition of navigable waters cuts across the entire statute, so both agencies have to be involved. Chief Justice Roberts called on the agencies to promulgate a rule. Breyer called upon the agencies to promulgate a rule. Justice Alito in the Sackett case, which came along later, once again called upon the agencies to promulgate a rule. So here we are. We've got a rule. Somebody's got to make a decision about where to draw this fuzzy line on federal jurisdiction, and EPA has done so. The Bush policy, I didn't realize Brent had a role in that, was not a bad guidance document as an early document, but it had some flaws in it. In any case, it's now being replaced by the EPA rule, so let's spend our time talking about that. The legal basis for the proposed rule, which will be final in due course within a few months at least, is the significant nexus test. My understanding and my reading of the case law is that that term actually first appeared in Swank, in Justice Rehnquist's opinion. It was a passing reference to the requirement for a significant nexus. It was not elaborated on at all. And the curious thing is, of course, the term doesn't appear in the statute, doesn't appear in the regulations, has never appeared in any of the case law that's developed over the history of the Clean Water Act until we got to the Swank case. And it's very curious that we're now talking about a test that doesn't have any anchor in the law, other than the Supreme Court decisions that we've got, which are either narrow or fractured. And if, to further complicate the irony, EPA has now decided to codify the significant nexus test as the legal basis for the proposed rule, which is exceedingly curious since it reflects the view of one justice, Kennedy, to which no other justice concurred. So isn't it curious? We have a national uniform standard of federal jurisdiction based on the opinion of one justice. But there we are. And frankly, EPA was right to adopt the significant nexus test. All of the circuit courts that have interpreted and applied Rapanos have accepted the significant nexus test as either an alternative basis for federal jurisdiction, an alternative to Scalia's plurality opinion test, or, in the case of the 11th Circuit, the only basis upon which the federal government can assert jurisdiction. So EPA is on absolutely solid legal ground, at least as we know to date, by basing its rule on the significant nexus test. It is by definition a ambiguous, hard to apply, hard to even envision. When you look at the map of the United States and you look at the different, you know, regional climactic conditions that exist in the United States, the idea of coming up with a uniform, transparent, easily understood and applied rule is complicated and daunting, to say the least. So EPA did something quite unusual. Brent mentioned it. They went out and did a study, a scientific study of what's the importance of headwaters to downstream traditionally navigable waters and their water quality. And the result was a 300-page, peer-reviewed, scientific analysis of the importance of headwater streams to water quality downstream. And in my view, at least, EPA has gone as far as it can reasonably go at this point to provide a solid scientific basis for its rule. We'll see, as Brenda said, we'll see how it plays out in court. But EPA, you know, rather than shooting from the hip and making it up, went to the trouble of compiling and analyzing all the literature that existed on the connection between headwater streams and traditionally navigable waters, and laid that out in the administrative record to eventually be reviewed in court. We do know that 40% of the sources that are currently regulated under the NPDES discharge permit program lie above what would be considered head of navigation of the tributary system of the United States. So not quite half of the sources would be eliminated if you took a really strictly limited definition of traditionally navigable waters for your tributaries. You'd leave out a lot of the sources of pollution. And something like 60% of the drinking water sources that supply water to communities around the land lie also in headwater areas. These are some of the factoids and some of the points that EPA's administrative record points out. Now to some of the more controversial questions. Does this rule represent, and I believe I heard Brent say this, others certainly have, represent an expansion of federal jurisdiction? Well, you know, what's your baseline for that? You could look at the pre-Swank case law over 30 years, and you could find examples of cases like Eidson in the 11th Circuit, which said all intermittent and artificial tributaries are jurisdictional, or Quivira Mining in the 10th Circuit, which said dry arroyos in Arizona are jurisdictional, or you could even look at the 4th Circuit's decision in U.S. Versus Deaton, authored by one of the more conservative panels in what is widely regarded as a conservative circuit, the 4th Circuit, which said that a wetland adjacent to a roadside ditch 20 miles from the Chesapeake Bay was obviously jurisdictional, and that the Corps' assertion of jurisdiction over, quote, the entire tributary system of the navigable waters of the United States, close quote, is jurisdictional. And furthermore, there's no Commerce Clause problem with asserting jurisdiction that broadly at all. So if I were to pick the Deaton case as the benchmark for what the federal jurisdiction was before Swank and Rapanos, I would say this proposed rule is a very significant reduction of federal jurisdiction over what formerly existed. How about ditches? Well, it turns out that the Philadelphia District of the Corps was the first district to promulgate a guideline on what they would do with ditches. It's called the Philly Ditch Rule. And the Corps said they would assert jurisdiction over any ditch that was functionally the same as a tributary, regardless of, you know, whether it was constructed or artificial or even perennial or intermittent. The only ditch that they would not assert jurisdiction over was one constructed wholly in an upland. That Philly Ditch Rule was challenged in court. The challenge was dismissed by the D.C. Circuit. So again, if you want to find a comparison point, is the current proposal for ditches greater than or less than what the Corps formally asserted? I would say less than, significantly, both because the ditch must be wholly constructed in an upland, and it must be perennial, not intermittent flow, and it must contribute significantly to downstream water quality in traditional navigable waters. So from my vantage point, the proposal on ditches is less than the jurisdiction the agencies were formally asserting, which had never been successfully challenged in court. I don't think the rule meaningfully changes the status of these other waters categories that Brent mentioned, these so-called geographically isolated wetlands, whatever the hell that term might mean. It certainly has no scientific meaning. But I don't think the rule meaningfully changes that. It's still going to be a case-by-case determination. I grant that EPA's estimate that it will only affect 3% of the so-called geographically isolated or other waters is nothing more than a guess, and I have no idea whether it's accurate or not. But I don't think the rule itself, and of course the environmental community is very critical of the fact that the rule doesn't go further to protect prairie potholes, Playa Lakes, Carolina Bays, and many other extremely valuable, at least from a biological standpoint, wetlands and water bodies. I will disagree somewhat with Brandt on how, you know, conclusive Swank and Rapanos were about limiting the scope of federal jurisdiction. Let's take Swank for a moment. Following Swank, there were something like 60 cases, in the lower courts, and except for the Fifth Circuit in a couple of kind of outlier cases dealing actually with the Oil Pollution Act, which has the same definition of navigable waters as the Clean Water Act, other than those cases in the Fifth Circuit, the government won every single one of the challenges to the assertion of its jurisdiction post-Swank. And all of the courts uniformly limited the holding in Swank to its terms, which was the Corps can't assert jurisdiction over water bodies based solely, and all the courts underlined solely, on the discredited migratory bird rule. That left open basing jurisdiction on all manner of aggregations, including flood control, water quality maintenance, fisheries habitat. Many other grounds for asserting jurisdiction over these other waters remained intact in place post-Swank. Then we come to Rapanos, and again, in Rapanos, you have no holding, you have no majority opinion, you have no consensus test, no definitive test or standard at all, and so you come to Kennedy's opinion, in which he very definitely disagrees and rejects Scalia's, the plurality opinion's formulation that adjacency for wetlands meant the requirement of a continuous surface connection. And Kennedy actually does say explicitly, wetlands may have value precisely because they aren't connected to other water bodies. And he cited, I have to, full disclosure, he cited an amicus brief I filed in the case, for the proposition that a lot of the value of some of these wetlands were that they were isolated from the predators that exist in navigable waters, fish predators and others, and gave and supported life forms that could only exist in those kinds of water bodies. So even in Rapanos, we don't have any definitive retraction of federal jurisdiction at all. There was no decision in Rapanos. The cases were remanded. The Rapanos case actually settled, never went to trial. Rapanos ultimately gave up, I guess, the fight and agreed that and paid a substantial penalty for filling the wetlands in his case. So we don't really have much to hang our hat on, I would say, with either Swank or Rapanos. Let me make three final kind of points, and I'm sure that some things I've said will spark some discussion. The aggregation issue, that is the heart of it. Brent's right. That's a and right along with that is the so-called limiting principle that comes from the latest jurisprudence under the Commerce Clause. You know, where is the line between federal and state jurisdiction? It's particularly difficult to draw these lines, how much to aggregate. What is Kennedy refers to aggregating the value of tributaries and wetlands, particularly wetlands, within the region. He's talking about, you know, similarly situated within the region. An unfortunate choice of words. If he had said watershed, we'd have at least some geographical notion of what he had in mind. But the word region doesn't tell us anything about what's the scope of the aggregation. It certainly doesn't tell us anything about how to apply the limiting principle that comes from, say, the Lopez and Morrison cases during the Rehnquist tenure under the Commerce Clause. And I'd be the first to admit, I don't know where you draw these lines. I mean, if you have to carve out a zone of authority for states over watersheds, I can't begin to come up with a principled way to do that. If folks on the call have thought about this and have ideas for how you do that, I'd welcome that, because I understand why it's a vexing issue for a lot of people. It seems like, to some, an overreach by the federal government. And yet, if the goal of a statute is to restore and maintain the chemical, physical, biological integrity of the nation's waters, Well, that sort of suggests you go where the waters go and you find the sources of pollution and address them wherever you find them. And if headwaters are as important as EPA's scientific study says they are to downstream water quality, well, then I guess you have to protect them. And if the states won't protect them, and of course the states are free to do so anytime they want, they can do so more stringently than the federal government, no problem with that. But in the absence of a state stepping forward and protecting headwaters, then it seems to me the federal government has the authority necessary and proper, shall we say, to discharge its obligations. Ultimately, this will come down to what happens to this rule. It will be finalized. It will be changed. Maybe a couple of comments on that. It's going to be changed to refine this, how ditches are handled. It's going to be changed to refine how the definition of tributaries is going to work and addressing some of the negative criticisms that EPA has gotten. It's going to be refined to address the criticisms they've gotten on the definition of adjacency and how floodplains are treated in this definition and what neighboring means. So I definitely see that the rule is going to undergo refinement, but it's not going to fundamentally change the direction that it's headed in. So then the question is, will it survive a challenge in the Supreme Court ultimately? And that probably will come down to another 5-4 decision. It will depend on who's on the court by the time the case works its way back up to the Supreme Court. Obviously, it will depend on whether the court agrees to take it, but there's a reasonable chance it would, I suppose. It may well come down to Kennedy once again. And Kennedy's vote is always based on pragmatism. He's a lot like O'Connor in that regard. He's always got an eye on the states and whether or not the states' prerogatives are being adequately considered and reflected in the rule. The fact that he declined to join the dissent in either Swank or Rapanos suggests he's not fully on board with maybe the broadest reach of federal jurisdiction that some of the judges might be willing to embrace. But just exactly where he falls on the spectrum of what he's willing to accept or not is unknown and probably unknowable until the case gets to the Supreme Court. And with that, I think I'll stop and open it up for a back and forth or whatever else is next.
Terrific. Thank you both for those opening remarks. Let me make a quick announcement about upcoming calls for Teleform. Tomorrow, Horn versus FDA will be the subject of a Courthouse Steps edition of Teleform. That case is returning to the U.S. Supreme Court. That's the Raisin Growers case. Our call will be tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Next week, we'll have both a preview of the gay marriage case on Tuesday before it is argued on Monday, rather. The preview Teleform is on Monday before the case is argued on Tuesday. And then we'll have a Courthouse Steps Teleform on Tuesday recapping the argument. That's next Monday and Tuesday. And then next Thursday, we'll be talking about the Glossop case argued Thursday in the Supreme Court. That's a death penalty drug cocktail case. That is on Thursday. But do check the Federal Society's website for other Teleform conference calls. This is the time of the year where the Supreme Court is announcing decisions, and we'll undoubtedly be covering some of those. I want to turn to the audience. We've got about 15 minutes left. In a moment, we'll hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And for our experts, if you have anything further you want to say in response to your opposite on today's call, maybe you can work it into your answers. I do want to try and get to the audience, even though we thought we'd have some back and forth. We've got three questions pending now in 15 minutes, so let's turn to our first question of the day.
I don't pretend to be an environmental lawyer, but what I don't understand is how the courts have totally ignored the traditional definition of navigable waters. These isolated water bodies and tributaries that are non-navigable, in my mind, clearly are not jurisdictional, yet the courts have managed somehow to totally ignore the concept of navigability, which comes from the original language of the Clean Water Act. It's mind-boggling to me how they've been able to get away with this travesty.
Brent, you want to take that?
I was going to let you respond to that because I kind of tend to agree with the caller.
Oh, well, I'm happy to. So the court in the Riverside Bayview case that Brent mentioned in 1985, the first case to look at the question of what is the extent of jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act and what does the term navigable waters mean under the Clean Water Act. And, of course, the statute defines navigable waters as waters of the United States, a term which is not further defined, unfortunately, by the statute, and not even described in the legislative history of the 1972 Act. So in Riverside Bayview, it was a unanimous Supreme Court, how often do we see that anymore, which ruled that Congress intended the term navigable waters to go beyond the scope of its traditional navigable waters jurisdiction and definition, for example, under the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1899, and to include waters that were not traditionally navigable. But of course, the Riverside Bayview Court did not say, where does that stop? Or what's the full extent of the jurisdiction of the federal government under the Clean Water Act? If it isn't limited to navigable waters, what is it limited by? And that's a vexatious question that we're still dealing with. But Riverside Bayview, Swank, Rapanos, all three Supreme Court decisions, even the conservative wing, if you will, of the Supreme Court, have all acknowledged, even Justice Scalia in his plurality opinion, have all acknowledged that the scope of jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act is beyond traditional navigable waters.
Yeah, and I'd absolutely agree with you. I think the concept of navigability is frankly irrelevant when you're looking at jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act these days. Except the connection between navigable waters. So any again, back to the Rapanos decision, a significant nexus to traditional navigable waters is itself sufficient for jurisdiction.
Yep.
All right, let's take another question.
This is Roger Candelaria. Thank you for the great discussion. It seems to me that the navigable waters, we have to actually go beyond that. There is a travesty here, and I think Hal Rogers' word grab is probably way too weak of a word, because when you look at the constitutional basis for navigable, it seems to me the language was Section 8, Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states. And by the kind of expansive interpretation that the litigators are taking, well, the United States could regulate the creeks in southern Africa if they wanted to, because that relates to commerce with foreign nations. So it's gotten clear out of reasons, way past any reasonable interpretation of the commerce power. I'd like your comments.
Go ahead, Brent.
Yeah, you know, once again, I appreciate folks' frustration with the fact that the term navigable really has little meaning and practicality as these decisions, jurisdictional decisions, are made, but that's the way it is. If Congress, again, doesn't believe that, you know, I mean, the Supreme Court has decided, and if Congress doesn't agree with the Supreme Court, then again, it's the Congress's decision to intervene and change the way that the statute is interpreted. So,
that's what they said about Dred Scott.
Yep.
So it sounds like, gentlemen, there's no way to put the genie back in the bottle. And I mean, one response to your suggestion, Brent, that Congress has to revisit this would be that, well, they said this in the first place, that it's navigable waterways, waters of the U.S. Maybe they felt they were being clear. I don't know. But we still got three questions pending. So let's turn to another caller here.
This is Jack Park. I'm not entirely clear on the biological and relation to isolated waters. Are the species involved endangered, or do they have to be endangered? And if so, isn't there another law that takes care of them than the Clean Water Act?
Some of them are endangered. Sorry, Brent, did you want to grab that?
Yeah, go ahead, and I'll follow up. I got some comments about that as well.
Okay, so, yeah, I mean, some of the species, for example, fairy shrimp, an unfortunate name, perhaps. Or maybe if they'd called it the Dwight D. Eisenhower shrimp, it would fare better. But the fairy shrimp exists in vernal pools. It's an example of a species that wouldn't exist if it were connected to other navigable waters, because it would be basically eaten by a lot of predators. But many of the species that exist in these so-called geographically isolated waters, other waters, or certainly that exist in non-navigable tributaries, are not endangered. But they are a part of the biological integrity of the waters of the U.S., as stated in the purpose of the Clean Water Act, and so therefore they have to be protected. I mean, water quality standards that are set to protect uses of water uniformly require maintenance of viable, biologically, BIP, it's called a balanced indigenous population of fish and shellfish in and on the water. So, you know, biology is interwoven into the fabric of the Clean Water Act and has been from the very beginning. And again, if you're serious about a law that's intending to protect these aquatic ecosystems, you have to protect the species that make up the ecosystem. Otherwise, you don't have an ecosystem. So, you know, once you've decided as a national priority that you want to protect the waters and their biological integrity, that takes you inevitably up the watershed to the headwaters.
Yep. And I think, Pat, you raise a really good point, and I think this is where it is very difficult to draw the line. But again, back to the issue, if there are waters of the U.S., there are waters of the state. So at some point, there is a demarcation between federal, states, and federal and private. And unfortunately, you know, as a former scientist and ecologist, I could argue that there's an interconnection between all these waters, between the state, the critters living in the state waters, and critters, you know, living in the federal waters. So they're back and forth. So there is, under that biological argument, there's simply no water body off limits to federal jurisdiction if you argue that biological connection alone is sufficient to establish jurisdiction. And, you know, despite, again, I go back to the issue, Pocosins, prairie potholes, playa lakes, all these things are extremely valuable habitats. They support many endangered species. But again, my view is that the authority under the Clean Water Act does not support their protection. And one of my growing concerns is, and I understand the frustration of the environmental community and scientists who say that these should be protected by the federal government. My point is, unfortunately, the Clean Water Act, as it's being interpreted, is being used less to protect water quality and more to protect habitat, which, again, if that's what Congress intended, then so be it. I don't think that that's what they intended.
Of course, I would just say Congress has had 40 years to respond to that, because it's not like this is new. We had 30-plus years of experience with the Clean Water Act interpreting it very broadly, as I've briefly outlined with some of the key cases, and not limiting it in any way that we're talking about today. And Congress sat there and watched this all unfold. It's interesting that when Scalia was confronted with this argument in Rapanos, he basically said, well, I don't recognize the prescriptive rights to an improper interpretation, and the fact that all these judges, you know, that have considered the question before me were wrong doesn't change my view that the statute should not be interpreted the way it's being interpreted.
Yep.
So Congress has had plenty of opportunity to step in if it wanted to, and still could at any moment.
But
that's right. I think go ahead, Dean.
Can I go back and to say that, you know, isn't the Endangered Species Act the way to protect habitat?
Not
one way. One way,
can
but it doesn't protect all that needs to be protected in an aquatic ecosystem. That wouldn't do it.
Yeah, I would agree. And also, I would just say, too, there's a lot of angst that if the federal government doesn't have the authority to protect all these water bodies, then they're all going to be destroyed, which I just think is a fallacy. The vast majority of states, and I would argue all states, have some laws on the books. In fact, most of them have laws on the books that actually protect isolated wetlands. In fact, provide greater protections than even under federal law. So this notion that if the federal law does not protect these, that we're going to lose all these waters just simply is not supported by, you know, by reality, in my view.
That may be true, Brent. I will say that only 17 states have wetland regulations, and that number hasn't changed significantly over the course of time. So it's questionable whether some of these wetlands, like prairie potholes in North Dakota, would be protected by North Dakota.
I agree, and I tell you, prairie potholes are a significant resource that need to be protected. The question is how and at what cost.
I agree. Yep.
What's the timing on those 17 states that implemented their own laws? Did they follow the federal law, or did they precede it? And is there some perception among the other states, the remaining, 27 states?
Many preceded it, particularly the Northeast. The Northeast, New England led the way, had wetland protection laws in advance of even the 1972 law. Since 72, I don't know, probably less than 10 states have added wetland regulatory programs. Some do both freshwater and saltwater or estuarine wetlands. Some just do one or the other. So they do vary. But the states that have not opted to adopt at least regulations, that doesn't mean, by the way, Brent is right on this point, that it doesn't mean that that states aren't doing something to conserve wetlands. It just means that most of the states don't regulate activities that fill and drain and destroy wetlands. That's all the point I would make.
Yep.
Yeah, but I guess my question went to the idea that possibly some of those states are just deferring to the federal laws that have already been put in place.
I think that's right. Dean, that would be my interpretation.
Okay. Let's head in another direction, perhaps, with our next caller.
Well, this has been very interesting. My name is Jim Haynes. I'm a member of the Federalist Society. And I was going to ask the discussants, I guess, to shift gears for a moment and try to think ahead, assuming that this regulation with some sort of window dressing becomes effective. What will be the next step? Where will the boundaries of the Clean Water Act be in, say, 5 years from now or 10 years from now? What do you think the government is going to do?
You want that one, Brad, or do you want me to go?
Yeah, let me just offer some thoughts. You know, I think first of all, if you talk to most stakeholders and even industry, they would be willing to concede to the government's broad assertion of broader jurisdiction if there was greater certainty, not only in what is federally jurisdictional, but also in getting permits. So, you know, I can't predict what's going to happen in 5 years, but what I would do is strongly urge us to move towards greater predictability, not only in the jurisdictional determinations, but in the regulated communities' efforts to permit and mitigate impacts to those jurisdictions. I think the sooner we have that resolved, the better off everybody is, because then the states can understand what is federally protected, what is not, and what they should then protect. But I think we're in this limbo right now. It creates huge uncertainty, and it's not healthy for anybody. It's not healthy for the environment or the stakeholders. So just, you know, again, so I hope EPA, at the second bite of the apple, to finalize this thing, gets things right, and provides greater certainty and clarity.
Now, I'm by a stakeholder. I have a faucet in my bathroom, and I pay taxes to support all of this. So do I get counted as a stakeholder?
Absolutely.
Yep, you are.
Okay.
You get a vote.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Okay. Now please go forward.
ultimately, I think we're going to need some maps. It's fraught because when you start putting colors on maps, people get nervous about that. But, you know, sometimes the question is, how much certainty do you want? If you want to know for sure in your state, in your Corps of Engineers district even, where exactly is the line, you're going to need a map. And that's going to require USGS capabilities with all the modern technologies that we have for small-scale GIS mapping. But that's what you're ultimately going to need. If you want to know how far this rule is going to go, you're going to have to map it.
Yeah, I would agree. And interesting note, Pat, when in 2006 and 2008 when we were developing the guidance, there was actually discussion by the Corps of Engineers and EPA to do some maps, but also put out, you know, visible pictures of the types of water bodies that would be subject to regulation and those that would not be subject, and there was significant pushback. Because, again, people are afraid to draw the line here. People are afraid that they're going to draw it, you know, give up too much or give up too little. So at some point, we've got to be willing to put the pen on the paper and draw the line and produce those maps.
Yep. And, you know, the rule does say with regard to tributaries, they must have defined bed and bank. They must have features that have taken years to develop, not erosional features on the landscape. That doesn't qualify as a tributary. And that's still pretty vague,
I guess I would. I mean, the proposal basically said that there are some upland streams, actually, that may not have bed and bank. You know, wetlands, upland wetlands that did not have bed and bank that would actually be tributaries. And so, I think the agency heard loud and clear that that wasn't appropriate. But the bed and
they're
bank.
They're going to correct that. Yeah, they're going to correct that. If they've confused wetlands with tributaries, they've got to correct that. But for tributaries, it's definitely going to be bed and bank defined. Features that have taken years to develop that are observable on the land.
Yeah, and here's the challenge as well, Pat. I think you know you may or may not agree, but you go out west to the dry auroras, you got bed and bank, and they're erosional features, but there's clearly a bed and bank, and sometimes water does not flow in those auroras for a year, 2 years, and even 5 years. And I think that's the frustration people have.
And Arizona, if you adopt a really strict definition of navigable waters, 90% of the waters of Arizona would be outside the scope of the Clean Water Act. So that's the other side of it. Some of these parts of the country are so arid and so dry that things that we in the East would never recognize as a tributary are, in fact.
Yep.
We're just about out of, well, technically we are out of time, but our experts have agreed that they could offer an extra minute or two. We have one question pending, so let's take a final call here.
Yes, what, if anything, can states do in light of this rule to assert jurisdiction or clarify their own jurisdiction, even including some sort of 10th Amendment radical showdown?
I'm not sure. You mean, could states say, even though the Corps says this is jurisdictional, we say it's not? Is that what you mean?
Sure, exactly.
Well, I don't know any constitutional provision that would support that notion.
Yeah, I'm not either. I will tell you that I know Environmental Council of States, ECOS, which represents the state commissioners, there was a number of states, notwithstanding the Northeast, but a number, well, including the Northeast, that basically do have laws and regulations in place protecting, again, these their own waters, and did push back because, you know, there's a lot of states that view this, again, as a federalization of state waters, and I think, you know, the concern is not only just the permitting issue, but the standards development, the TMDLs, and lots of other things that go along with potential expansion of the concept of jurisdictional water.
The closing comment is this is all good for lawyers, and those of us that are producing baby lawyers are only too happy to see all this controversy.
Indeed.
Well, we will have to let it rest there, gentlemen. I want to thank our experts, Brent Fuel and Professor Pat Parento, for your comments and staying with us extra long here today. To our audience, a reminder about our next scheduled Teleform conference call. That's tomorrow at 3 p.m., Courthouse Steps edition of Teleform, when we'll be looking at the Raisin Growers case, Horn versus FDA. It's going to be argued tomorrow. Our call is at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.